listening to the Potato Podcast, presented by Columbia Media Group. You could listen to past episodes on thepotatopodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you enjoy the episode, be sure to give us a like and leave a review. On today's episode, Dave joins James Baker. James Baker Farms was the cover story from the May-June issue of Potato Country magazine. He talks about the struggles of being a tenant farmer and growing on a contract. This episode is sponsored by Syngenta Elatus.
Protect the perimeter of your potato crop with Elatus fungicide from Syngenta. When applied in furrow at planting, Elatus controls Rhizoctonia and suppresses verticillium wilt, giving your potatoes long-lasting protection during early development. Talk to your local Syngenta retailer about Elatus.
Always read and follow label instructions. Please check with your local extension service to ensure registration status. Syngenta supports a FIFRA 2EE recommendation for suppression of verticillium wilt on potatoes in certain states.
Hello, listeners. Thank you for joining the Potato Podcast. Today, we have with us James Baker. And James is a tenant farmer in Moses Lake, Washington, which means he farms on rented ground, and he's got some interesting perspectives on that, which we'll get into later. But he was also the featured grower in the May-June issue of Potato Country. Again, very interesting article. I will put a link off the pod here so that you can read more information. But first, we're going to start off talking about how this season is progressing in Washington. Planting was late, and the weather was real bad. But have you caught up from the late start, James?
Yes, we are. Well, up here in the North Basin, we're starting to catch up. On the 10-year average heat units-wise, we're right in the middle. We're a couple days behind. We're within, a couple days. I know South Basin, their early planted stuff is, 10, 12 days off. I think the earlier crop's going to suffer a little more, but I think mid-season's fine, and then it just depended on how late people got in the ground planting.
So looks like it might pan out, though, to be a decent year.
It could. That's the joys of raising spuds. It's always changing.
Right. That's the joy and the challenge, right? So, in the Potato Country article, your story, you had a very unique perspective about turning a profit and sometimes having to make some sacrifices to do that. And since you farm on rented ground, your profit margins are very slim. According to the story, you cut inputs, maybe run some older equipment, and use other cost-saving methods. I'd like to give you the forum now to talk about that some more.
Well, it just, we could talk about this all day. But, one of the problems that we chase is they've got this neck down to where there's really just not a lot of money in it. And I don't know, I figure that every time you stub your toe on a field, it takes four fields to pay for one bad field. And out of every five fields, one's always bad. So, there is, on paper, there's some money in this game, but in reality, there's really not. We used to go on our fungicides. We would start, and then we would just apply on a calendar because we didn't want to get stuck. We didn't want to take the risk, so we just apply. And we raised some great spuds that way. But it's just gotten to the point where the margin's not there. So now we spend more time scouting in the field, walking the field, trying to do a better job of sneaking days off on our water, really trying to be – try to never start the season off without ever getting behind. One thing I did that a lot of guys would probably disagree with is I took all soil moisture monitoring probes out of my fields. What I found is when I'd get behind and I'd be in a hurry, I would look at my app and go, oh, well, we're okay, and I'd make calls off of that because I was behind, and I wouldn't, because I would get spread out over, you know, 70, 80 square miles, and sometimes you just can't get everywhere, and so I started relying on that, and I'd make mistakes because I was counting on that. So I took those out, and I go to every field every day, and I walk every field every day, and I've been able to cut a lot of those by having the water and everything just right. I'm able to cut a lot of those applications down and use less products.
Yeah, so that's pretty interesting that you're going back off of precision type of agriculture and relying more on scouting and walking the fields.
Yeah, just for me, I mean, it doesn't fit for everybody, but for me, I got to where I would count on it, and then I wouldn't get there like I should because, you know, there's always a problem somewhere, and I would use it as an excuse not to get there. Or it would just, you know, well, I was there yesterday, and this looks fine. So I just went away from that in every field every day, walking it.
So the you grow on a contract, and they're processed potatoes. And in the story, sounds like you've got some issues with the end price that the contracts are paying the growers.
Yeah, I think that, you know, especially up here in the Columbia Basin, these plants, they thrive on quality, at least the processors I deal with. They want quality, 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 and they want us to be perfect all the time. And at the end of the day, the money's just not there. We're not keeping up with inflation. We're being forced to cut corners, and they have the ability to pass it down and pay it. And really, they just hold it because those of us left in the game, we love it. It's what we do. We just keep doing it, and they know it. And basically, in my opinion, they're taking advantage of the fact that we're just potato growers, and that's what we like to do. And, you know, basically when we say we need more money, they're like, well, I got five of your neighbors wanting another contract, so why should we pay you more?
It makes it tough. What can you do? What can you do about that?
Well, one of them is, I think you kind of do what I do and not just shoot for perfection all the time. Try to be good enough to make a quality, but, you know, shoot for profit instead of quality.
And that is what I found most interesting about your frankness and willing to put that out there. Did you get any pushback from the contractors?
Well, I've had a little pushback this year and some setbacks, but that happened before this article came, so my attitude towards it hasn't been very quiet. They kind of already know. I have a habit of not keeping my mouth shut. So
well, that's why you're on the podcast right now, I guess.
Yep, probably getting myself in trouble again.
So
that's all right.
Well, all right. We'll try to do our best to get you in trouble. How about that? So when we were visiting the other day, you were telling me that you thought that wildfire smoke has become an issue, especially in the valley there, that you're having some phantom diseases. I've heard talk of there's been more bruising in the crop. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it just Well, about the last 3 years in a row, we've had really bad smoke come in, and it seems to suck in, and it'll be here for a month. And it seems like every year it seems to have a different effect on the crop. I mean, you can see it in the field. I remember I have, what was it, 2017, I had a field that kind of sat down in a, like in a little valley. And I walked out and hit one day, and it was just, the smoke was so thick I couldn't hardly get back to my pickup. Just started hacking up the lung, and you're just like, well, you know, these spuds need fresh air and sunlight. It's not, if I can't even walk the field, what are they going through?
I don't think we know all the consequences.
Yeah, you know, and you know, the one year we had some stuff that looked a lot like purple top, but supposedly it wasn't purple top. I had a couple fields like that, and they kind of come in and stayed. And once the smoke left, they kind of perked back up a little bit. I did have some good luck on those fields. We threw some bite aid at them, and it didn't reverse anything, but it kind of stopped the digression, and they kind of stayed, you know, the foliage kind of stayed about the same from when we applied it.
Uh-huh.
So I think that helped out. And then last year, a lot of people's everybody's bruise free in our area was really low, and maybe it's another factor, but it, you know, there's not a lot of other things to add it up to, and we know the smoke's affected them.
And that's not going away. Some of the wildfires are because of the drought in the West, you know, the record droughts and that kind of thing. But what do you think on these?
I think a lot of it is necessarily not, well, I mean, droughts, there's always droughts. I think it more has to do with we're not grazing as heavy as we used to. We're not logging as heavy as we used to. There's a lot of things I just don't think the forests are being managed the way they used to be. And when a fire does take off, we're always going to have fires. But they used not to be these Mondo fires because they run out of fuel and quit. If they're grazed down, it doesn't matter how dry it is.
What are you suggesting here?
Well, what I think needs to happen, and it's not going to happen, is we need to more grazing, more logging, but get back to managing our forests.
Less fuel, less fire.
Less fuel, less fire. And then, you know, graze areas so that when a fire does come, because you never know where the fire is going to be, but if we graze certain sections really heavily or log certain sections, when it burns up to that point, they can get ahead of it. You know, have some natural fire lines in there.
Right.
But I don't know. I
don't know how we accomplish that.
I'm a farmer. I don't know, but that's just my observation.
Yeah. All right. So what about nematode populations in your area? What are you finding? Finding a lot, aren't you? What are you doing about it?
Yeah, we're getting more and more nematodes in the area. It's getting to where I'm renting and dancing around. We used to get away with, you know, 15 gallons of telone. Now it's getting to pretty much, if we do telone, it's 20 gallons. And then anywhere we don't do telone, we're, you know, we get a sample and we're not seeing anything, we keep bite aid in the budget. And then we're sampling later. We've gone to where I even have stuff that we've treated had problems. So now we're soil sampling. We start soil sampling in July, August for nematode out in the field. And then if we've got anything that shows up, we'll start doing a Vite program.
Yeah, and it's an ongoing battle in our area as well, in the Idaho area, a lot of them. So basically, telone is what you're saying, and Vite for what you've been using.
Telone, Vite what I've been using. I've also switched. I haven't been hardly using any Vapam. I've switched to Strike 100. I've also used some Strike 80, but I like telone Strike at the same time because I am a tenant farmer. A lot of times we wind up picking ground up last minute, so I do a lot of spring fumigating, and I think that the telone Strike is the way to go with that. You get back in the field, the re-entry is quicker one time through the field, and I've had great success. I haven't had any major burr problems or anything like that where I've used Strike. I think it's a good product, and that's kind of the way I've switched my program.
What other tips or insight do you have for growers listening to this?
Oh, man. For me, biggest key is, like I said earlier, walk the field every day. Got to be in the field every day. It's. I think we got to remember that it's not just a science, it's an art. And I like to walk the fields and listen to them. You're in them every day. You don't get surprises. And I think a lot of times we get in hurries and we don't make times to be there. If you're there every day, you're gonna know what's going on.
So better management, better decision making through observation is what you're saying, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I think for a lot of time we kind of got hung up. Everybody wanted these magic foo-foo. I call them magic foo-foo juices or snake oils to fix our problems. But I mean, if the ground's not good, if the weather's not right, if your timing's not right, and Mother Nature's not there, it doesn't matter what magic foo-foo juice you put on there. you got to have the basics. Have got to be right. Kind of, that's what I did. I just kind of took it back to basics. And if when I get the basics mastered, I guess I'll move on to fancier programs.
Right on. And then as far as the profitability goes, I want you to touch on that once more. And there may be a disconnect for some people listening to this to say, sacrifice some quality for better profits. And that's what I find the most fascinating about what you're doing. Just give me a couple more examples of how you're doing that.
Well, for one example, I had a field a few years back. They were umatillas. It was a home run. Just knocked it out of the park. They were going direct to plant, going delivered to plant after we ran them through the eliminator and everything, transloading them. I delivered 39.5-ton umatillas to the plant. Quality was great. Everything was off the charts. Did great. Just should have been a home run. At the end of the day, added it all up, I lost $15 an acre on that field.
Wow.
We spent so much money raising the perfect crop, there was nothing left over.
Right.
And so you don't have to. I'd have been better off to have spent, you know, $500-$600 an acre less and got a lower yield. And so it's a balance, right? So, I mean, it comes across wrong and it sounds weird, but it's finding the balance between what do I have to spend? And, like, one of the things that I did wrong on that crop, it was my first year raising directs. I was doing my normal fungicide program, my late blight program, my everything that I would do to make them, you know, rid of mill and all the other stuff to make them store better, but they're going direct. So cut all that stuff out. And, that, you know, that's my fault. But there's just little things. You got to know what variety you're raising and what you're doing and figure out which corners you can cut to save costs and which ones you can't. Because sometimes you can't. You got to spend the money. You can't shoot yourself in the foot. But sometimes, you know, that last pass of fertilizer, is this going to return? I guess I was kind of always raised, we just did whatever the potatoes needed. You know, if we thought they needed it, we gave it to them. I've gone away from that. If it's not going to pay me to do it, I'm not going to do it.
So very interesting. Keep an eye on the bottom line and make sure what you're doing is actually going to pay off. Go ahead.
When you say it that way, you're like, well, of course, it's a business. Why wouldn't you do that? But at least in our operation, we got caught up and we're trying to raise really, you know, we were just doing whatever it took to raise a great crop and thought that was going to pay us back, and it didn't work out. Because no matter what you do, you spend a bunch of money to raise, you know, a perfect crop. If it's 105 degrees for 3 weeks straight with 40-mile-an-hour winds and smoke rolls in the last week of July, it doesn't matter how you're not going to get the perfect crop. And so it's kind of, you know, just managing, not spending so much that when you do have something you can't control knock you down, you can survive it. Because the problem is that if you shoot for the perfect crop and you don't get it, you lose so much money you can't survive.
And you've had challenges every year, according to the article, is a question for you. And so you're one of those guys that are really in the front lines and battling it out. So we appreciate your perspective on this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but that's where I'm at on things nowadays. So
you talk about margins in the article, and because you are renting your ground and you're not a multi-generational farmer where the ground is paid off, you've got costs that some of these guys can't even relate to. How does that work? I mean, makes it tough for you, right?
Well, yeah, it makes it tough, and that's one of the reasons why I think I get a little more frustrated with the price than other guys you know, if you've got a guy that has paid for ground, he's operating on his own money or a lot of his own money or mostly paid for ground, and he's renting a little bit and he pushes it across there. In our area, you know, a guy with an operation like that, they've got a $600 to $800 advantage on someone like me. And so if you just take 1,000 acres for easy money, you're 600 to 8. They're making, when I'm breaking even, they think they're turning a profit of 600 to 800,000 in a year. What's frustrating to me is at the end of the day, if they rent the ground out, they'd be making the same amount of money, and then they'd have all their operating capital they could go spend on other investments and make more money. They'd make more money not farming.
Huh.
But they are turning a profit. And that's where we keep getting beat up, is at the end of the day, you know, they've got sheds, they've got employees, they've got, you know, all this infrastructure, and they don't want to give it up. And I understand that. I wouldn't if I was in the same situation. But the hard part is that that's where we keep losing in the negotiating tables, because they know that we're just going to keep doing it. And that those guys, I mean, it sounds like big numbers, but at the end of the day, to be sustainable and to be able to pass it on to the next generation and keep things going and alive, these current potato prices aren't going to do it.
Right. And then your challenge is just expanded to the nth degree with having to pay that that rental fee.
Well, you're paying rent, you're paying interest, I finally have a little tiny shop that I rent, but for 10 years I just ran out of the back of my pickup, didn't even have a shop. We just fixed stuff in the landlord's corners on the edge of the field, and so some stuff has to go to town that a lot of guys have the infrastructure to fix at their place, which is, that's all paying your dues, and that's fine. But at the end of the day, it's got to pay off sometime.
Right.
There's not the, when an established operation has a bad year, there's equity and a margin to pull back on. When there's, I have, every year's a make or break. There is no equity or margin, because we're building it as we go.
All right. Well, James Baker, we want to thank you for taking the time with us today. I should mention he's out driving around and scouting fields right now as we're conducting this interview. So thank you again for your time, and good luck with this year's crop and in future.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a good day.
Views and opinions expressed on this podcast are for informational purposes only, and solely those of the podcast participants, contributors, and guests. They do not constitute an endorsement by or necessarily represent the views of Columbia Media Group or its affiliates.